This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Advances in cancer treatment seem to be coming at a faster clip, and that can be attributed in part to breakthroughs in immunotherapy research. Immunotherapy is where the body, with the help of a vaccine, uses its own immune system to attack cancer cells. Well, one of the researchers making those advances is Pinko Mukherjee, the Erwin Belk Endowed Distinguished Professor of Cancer Research in the Department of Biological Sciences at UNC Charlotte. Her work has been described as groundbreaking, transforming the way cancer is diagnosed and treated. She's also an entrepreneur as the founder of a company that develops products that span the life cycle of cancer from initial diagnosis through treatment and recurrence monitoring. And she's also been lauded as an inspiration to her students, recently honored with the O. Max Gardner Award. That's the highest faculty accolade given by the Board of Governors at the University of North Carolina among all 17 campuses. We asked Pinko Mukherjee to join us for the hour to share some of what she's doing in the fight against cancer. And guess what? She said yes. And she's here with us this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you. My pleasure.
Well,
nice to have you here. I understand that you listen a lot to the program.
Yes, I do.
That's a very scary thought. Let's start with the award that you recently won, the O. Max Gardner Award. He was a former governor. That's where the name comes from. It's the highest faculty accolade, as I said, and the only award for which all of the faculty members on all of the campuses get to vote on the winner, and they're all eligible to be nominated. It's made to the faculty member who has made the greatest contribution to the welfare of the human race. That's very impressive. What has it meant to you?
Wow. Very humbling. Extremely humbling. I was just absolutely surprised that I was selected out of so many people, so many faculty, so many of my colleagues. It has been a huge honor for me to get this. And my daughters, my father, my husband, they were all there when I received the award. It was very overwhelming. And, you know, the fact that it says it's the betterment of human race really makes me want to do more, you know, to really prove that, yes, what I'm doing will affect a large number of people.
I went through the nomination packet that they put together for this award, and it includes not just nominations from the chancellor at UNC Charlotte and people that you, the usual suspects. It's people outside the university, at other universities, in private research, places like the MD Anderson Cancer Center, writing about you in glowing terms, in terms of the work that you have done. Obviously, this award gives you a little kick and a little encouragement to go forward, but I don't think you need that encouragement from looking at what you have done to get this award. You love what you do.
I love what I do. Absolutely would not trade it for anything else. I just absolutely love what I do.
Why?
Because I see that there is something that I can really translate into the clinic without really having the pressure of doing it. You know, it really is something you bring from the bench to the bedside, but you don't have to. There is no pressure to do that for scientists. We do our research, and if the path leads us to that, that's where we go. But if it doesn't, it just stays as basic research, and we train the students to do really good science. So in every way, my job is really very, what can I say? Very, very encouraging, very nice. I love it. And that's why I love it. You know, it's not that I have to do this. Mm-hmm. It's something that comes naturally to me. It's something I've just been doing forever. And it just led me to make discoveries that I never thought I would make when I started to do science.
Do you ever think about the randomness of all this, that you can do what you want, you can take your research where you want it to go, something today when you go back to work might trigger you to think, you know, let's go here, let's see what happens if we go here. That's fairly random, it seems to me. I mean, although you'll find, you'll make discoveries, and you have made discoveries, what are you missing? Because of the randomness of it all.
I think the missing part is really the disappointments many times that you have. So you have a hypothesis that you think, oh, wow, this is a wonderful hypothesis. It's going to lead to this. And it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And it leads to something completely different. Or it leads to something saying, I can't do this. This is not working out. You know, so there is a lot of disappointments, lots and lots. Plus, you always have to worry about getting funding to do these things, which, you know, fortunately, I have been lucky to get funding from the government to do this. There is no venture. There is no bank that funds us. It's really the taxpayers' money that we get and some foundations that fund us. But really, it's the public that's funding us to do this, and we have a responsibility to that. So it is disappointing when what we propose to do doesn't get, see the fruition of what we wanted to do.
Is that part of the problem? I mean, if every scientific piece of research was going to culminate in success, I'm sure the funding would be very easy to get.
Yes.
But because there is that element of failure occasionally from time to time, some people are reluctant to give it because it's a lot of money over the course of it. But we don't give enough. Not enough money is going in. If enough money was going into researchers like projects like you work on and other scientists work on, where do you think we'd be today? Would we have kicked cancer? Would we have cured it by now?
I don't know if we would have cured it. Of course, that's a very hypothetical question. But yes, we would have made, we've already made huge strides in cancer treatment, diagnosis, early diagnosis. And we still continue to do that. But absolutely, certainly, we need more money put into this to fund younger investigators who are, you know, who have out-of-the-box thinking, who are not set in their ways right now. People like us are kind of set in our ways. You know, we kind of are channelized our energy into one thing, and we're really working to make that work. However, younger people really don't have that. They're open. Their mind is open to many different things, and they can really move it to a level which we haven't done so far. So I think a lot of money needs to be put in there, a lot more than we are getting right now.
It is said that if you don't make a name for yourself in the field of physics at a very young age, by the time you're 30, you're not going to do it because all these younger minds coming up behind. Is that what we're talking about here, the same principle that you come in like a sponge?
Yes.
And with all these ideas and opportunities, as opposed to getting pigeonholed into something that, well, I'm good at this, so I'm going to stick with this.
Yes.
That if you don't make a name for yourself as a biologist or as a research scientist working on cancer, by the time you're 30, it's not going to happen for you?
No, 30, I think, is still young. What I have seen and known, and there is statistics to tell me that it's about the age of 40, 42, really, right, that you can really, in biological sciences, I don't know much about physics, but in biological sciences, that's when really you get the funding to do what you want to do.
Hmm.
You know, before that, it's really very rare. So the average age, actually, to get the, you know, the $2 million or, you know, $1 million, $2 million from the government to do what you want to do, your own idea, your baby, your thoughts, is really, that's the average age now, which is really sad.
Yeah.
It should be much younger.
We're going to talk about your work and what you've done and what you've discovered and the vaccine you've developed and ways to detect cancer at the early stages in a little while. But the goal, I would guess, as a researcher, is to uncover something that leads to better treatment, perhaps ultimately a cure for cancer. Where are we in that search? And do you think that if we find a cure or we find a procedure that identifies one particular cancer, that it can be applied to many cancers?
Yes, it can be applied to many cancers because cancers are designated as epithelial or hematopoietic or sarcomas. You know, so if it's an epithelial cancer, which is of all of your epithelial organs, which means your stomach, your pancreas, your breast, your, you know, esophagus, your, you know, colon, they're all from the epithelia. mm-hmm. epithelial lining, the okay. lining of the ducts. And so you can imagine that you can, you know, if you find something for, say, a pancreatic cancer that might work for colon cancer and vice versa, you know, and if you find something for prostate, it might work for breast. So it is possible. However, most researchers work on one cancer or another, or maybe couple cancers, like I do. I work on breast and pancreas primarily, but that doesn't mean I haven't worked on colorectal and I haven't worked on other cancers. I have ovarian and stuff like that. But it, again, we get pigeonholed into where we can get funding for.
You're right. We've done, and other programs, both on NPR and commercial television, have done shows recently, a lot of them, on advances in cancer diagnosis and treatment. And it seems, because of those programs, that something is happening out there, that the speed of discovery has hastened. And maybe it's just because of immunotherapy. Is that, am I imagining that? Is it just my being inundated with stories about this? Or has the speed of discovery, in fact, increased?
It has increased. It has increased because of the genomes. The discovery of the genetics of cancer has really opened up the field to doing new targets, to discovering new targets. And therefore, because there are these new targets, you can do immunotherapy to those new targets, or even the old targets that we didn't know how to attack before. So immunotherapy actually has been going on since the 1800s.
Really?
Really.
How so?
So,
because we all think of this as brand new within the last 10 or 15 years.
No, it is not. It is, you know, if you have an immune system that can fight cancer, you would. So your body is constantly fighting it all the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the 1800s, they decided to treat a patient with just toxins from bacteria so that the cancer would go away because your immune system would be revved up because of that infection.
So they were smart enough to know that back
yes,
then?
Yes, yes, they were.
Okay.
They were. And after that, in fact, I think it was in MD Anderson that they actually treated with something called BCG. It's again a bacterial, bacteria that they treated the patients with. And they saw remarkable, recovery from bladder cancer, from some sarcomas. And so it has been going on for a long time.
Well, why then do we think it's so new? There was this big 60 Minutes piece not too long ago about giving the polio virus to people who have geoblastomas and tumors in their brain?
Neoblastomas.
And it seemed like revolutionary thinking. It's not.
It's not revolutionary thinking. It's what you can do with already existing information, really. So it's not revolution that we know that our immune system can fight cancer. What's revolution is that how can we engineer our body's immune system to fight it? Now, one thing is infection, right? But infection can cause other problems, and therefore they are not as popular. But now, if you can imagine that the infection is causing some kind of immune cells to be generated, can we take those immune cells instead and activate them outside of your body and then put it back in?
Wow.
Now you don't have the infection in your body, but your cells are the same that will fight the cancer.
Dr. Pinko Mukherjee is our guest. We're going to talk about her work and her path to success in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Business North Carolina magazine, covering the economy, industry, and business of North Carolina each month. June features the state's largest banks and credit unions. Subscriptions online at businessnc.com and at the App Store. And Griffin Brothers Tire, Wheels, and Auto Repair, family-owned, serving the Charlotte area since 1961. 10 convenient locations featuring tire and automotive repair. Details at griffinbrothers.com. Well, summer will be here on Sunday. That means a lot of summer food and drink is being consumed. Certainly now it's 99 degrees today. But we want to get some new ideas, perhaps some new twists on some old standbys. So Peter Reinhardt, our chef on assignment, will share some recipes with seasonal ingredients. A beverage consultant mixes up some refreshments with seasonal ingredients. And we hear about where to find those ingredients just in time for summer cookouts tomorrow morning on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Pope Francis called for urgent action on climate change, citing concerns for the earth and the poor, global environmental policy, and the role of the Roman Catholic Church.
That's the Diane Rehm Show, coming up next from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded public radio or 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and our guest today is Dr. Pinko Mukherjee, the Irwin Belk Endowed Distinguished Professor of Cancer Research at UNC Charlotte, working very successfully, actually, on the development of vaccines and forms of early detection for breast and pancreatic cancers, among others. We've had conversations with other researchers about the promise of immunotherapy, which we've been talking about just before the break. You believe that in the future, immune therapies and vaccines will be used to fight cancer just as they are used today to prevent infectious diseases. Why do you believe that? Because that's where the research is taking us, or because you just have your research has shown that that is going to be the most effective way to do it?
Of course, my research and other people's research are showing that, for sure. And I believe that almost all of the diseases that we've been able to combat, really combat, has come from immunotherapy. Other than the discovery of penicillin, everything else you can imagine you get vaccinated for, and therefore you don't get that disease. So we've eradicated a lot of disease with vaccines.
And in fact, you have said you don't believe there is any other way to fight cancer other than to program your own body to do the fighting.
I think so, but I may be biased because I really believe I'm an immunologist by training. That's what I trained in, and I really believe that that's the future, because our immune system is strong enough to do that. In fact, our cancers develop because our immune system fail. So when you get your first mutation, we have ways of taking those cells out. So if the DNA gets nicked, or, there is a mutation, there is DNA repair enzyme that fixes it. If they don't get fixed, the cells will become altered. And as soon as the cell is altered or producing different proteins, then your immune cells will go and catch it and eat it up.
Talk to me about what cancer is, because there's breast cancer, there's prostate cancer, there's skin cancer, there's brain cancer, there's cancer of the esophagus, there's, you name it, there's a cancer. But what is it? At its fundamental state, what is cancer?
I think the way we know it, it is 200 diseases or more together. It's not one disease, because it's a single mutation first, and then multiple mutations take place. We do not recognize when that cell becomes from normal to malignant. If we recognize that, and now we know the genes that might be doing it, then we can probably stop it from becoming really cancerous and malignant.
Well, what's the difference? People get benign tumors. They're not cancerous, but they are growths. There are situations where the cells have somehow been misprogrammed and grow out of control into a situation that either needs to be removed or you can live with it. Mm-hmm. But then there are cancerous tumors. What's the difference?
The genes, the mutations, and the proteins that are produced because of those mutations that can cause the cells to become crazy and get into the basement membrane and get out and go into another organ. And all of that programming that happens in the cell is what changes it from a benign to a malignant. So benign tumors are usually the ones that don't have those genetic traits. So the nucleus is still okay. The nucleus is not going crazy.
Do we know why sometimes a cell will just become malignant? Do we understand the fundamental thing that's happened there or what triggered it to happen?
Many, many, many researchers are working on that. So still no answer, one answer to it. There are many changes that happen that can change, that can turn a benign cell into a malignant cell. And there are so many switches that happen. Some say it's an angiogenic switch, which means new blood vessel formation. Some say it's a growth factor switch. Some say it's something, you know, so there are many, 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 many factors, and people are working on those factors. If we understand really that, how to stop that process from happening, it would be a breakthrough.
And people have said that one of the things that allows cancer to take over and grow at such a rapid clip and cause serious problems and death is because the immune system doesn't see it anymore. It doesn't recognize it. The cancer is putting out some sort of material that causes the immune system just to make it invisible.
Correct.
What you're doing is waking up the immune system.
Correct.
How does the cancer cell do that? Why doesn't the body see it as a foreign substance?
Oh, it does. The body sees it as foreign, very much so.
Why can't it fight it on its own? If you're using the immune system to fight it, why can't it fight it without your help?
Yeah, it cannot fight it because the cancer itself, the tumor cells itself are spewing out. They have a wonderful way of adapting. So they will adapt themselves and spew out immunosuppressive agents that would suppress your immune cells from doing anything to it. So they will kill the immune cells before the immune cells can actually do anything to it. Do you see the difference? So you might have a lot of immune cells floating around in your body while you have an antibodies that you would have when a tumor is growing. But those cells can't go and kill that tumor. One, because the tumor hides. There is something called MHC, class 1 and class 2. And if the cells don't see that in the context of the tumor, they can't go and kill it. And the tumors have a way to downregulate that. Then the tumors will spew out immunosuppressive agents and things like PDL and, you know, all of the things that are bad for the immune cells, you know. So what we are trying to do really is to avoid the tumors from becoming immunosuppressive. So the checkpoints that the tumors are using to attack the immune cells, you're trying to stop that and activating the immune cells, both at the same time. You have to do both at the same time so that the immune cells that you're generating because of your vaccine or any kind of immunotherapy can go there and not get killed and not get energized, we call them, or non-functional within the tumor microenvironment. So the tumor microenvironment itself is really horrible for the immune cells. And then there are some immune cells that change. It's even worse than just making the tumor cells die. They change those immune cells from really a killer cell to a tumor-promoting cell.
Wow. It's almost as though the cancer is an intelligent entity.
Extremely intelligent.
Really?
Extremely intelligent.
Is that the right word to use,
intelligent? I would use cancer is the most intelligent cell in our body because it can, you know, we haven't been able to really, you know, it's like like the police following a robber who is really smart, and the robber is always outdoing the police.
One step ahead.
And, you know, that's the issue right now. But there are strides made.
And you've developed, you are developing vaccines, and others are working on the same thing, or different vaccines, to fight the cancer by strengthening the immune system by working in concert with it? Does it work by working in concert with your immune system or by alerting the immune system that something bad is going on? How does it work? What's it actually telling the immune system, your vaccine?
It's activating the immune system very specifically to a protein that is expressed only on tumor cells and not on normal cells. So you can imagine any chemotherapy or radiation is attacking the entire body. You know, they cannot distinguish between a tumor or a normal cell. But in this case, in a vaccine case, we are educating the immune cells to just recognize the tumor, and the tumor has a particularly different antigen or protein that it goes and attacks. So that's what we are trying to do. However, there are new things. The other thing that immunotherapy that I'm working on very, very hard on is this antibody that we have developed. And that's what spun out the company. This antibody can actually be conjugated to different drugs so that you're not carpet bombing now. You're going as, you know, a drone strike and going directly to the tumor rather than going anywhere else.
This takes us to a whole new way to treat cancer, because right now we are carpet bombing.
Yes.
Chemotherapy is, in most cases, many cases, is very unpleasant for everybody involved. You lose your hair, you're sick, you feel awful the week of your chemotherapy. Radiation therapy does damage to the body, even to the good cells around the cancerous cells. What you're talking about is being able to target with laser beam accuracy only the cancer cells.
Correct.
Now, in the 60 Minutes piece that I saw about this being used on neoblastomas, the patient still got very sick for a couple of weeks, very sick. I'm almost to the point of death. I mean, it was horrible. But when they came out of it, they're fine, and the tumor has gone and has not come back. Will there be opportunities to lessen the problems involved with treating cancer through immunotherapy and through vaccines so that it will become almost you don't even notice that you're having a problem?
Yes, that's the hope. That is the hope. Because what it does, the dream of all immunotherapists is that when we do this type of treatment, that we will generate memory cells. Which means anytime the tumor recurs, because you don't die of your primary tumor. You know, we have found ways of removing them and treating them well with, you know, chemotherapy and radiation. And, you know, you can live quite nicely without having to worry about it. But it recurs. And when it recurs, now it is completely resistant to the chemotherapy that you had given, completely resistant to the radiation therapy, because the tumor cell, the stem cell that produces the tumor again, knows that I was getting this chemotherapy, right? So it becomes resistant to it. So the hope for immunotherapy is that we'll be able to generate memory cells, which is what a vaccine does for polio or for anything
else. Well, let's talk about that, because you're talking about using a vaccine as a treatment for somebody who has presented with a particular cancer. In the case of polio and other, like smallpox, other diseases, we take vaccines before we ever have any markers, any indication. We're not sick. We don't have those diseases. And the vaccines prevent us from getting them. Do you see a day when we will all get cancer vaccines that will prevent us from getting cancer? Or will it always be used only after the cancer is present?
So far, I think it will be after the cancer is present, but it would be something that you take after you take out the major cancer out. So it would be for recurrence. So the breast cancer vaccine that's out in the clinic from Mayo, when I was at Mayo Clinic, is for minimal residual disease. That means they were stage 3-4 breast cancer patients who've already had their tumors removed, have, you know, had their chemotherapy, radiation, and 6 months after that, they get the vaccine. So that, you know, we make sure that, because stage 3-4 breast cancer patients will recur, 90% of them will recur in 2 or 3 years. So if you give it in that window, you now have generated an immune response that will probably not let the tumor come back. So as soon as the tumor starts, you can attack it.
Where are you in the clinical trials for that? Because I know you're working with the Mayo Clinic in clinical trials. How long has that been going on? What have you discovered? And do you think that you can say with 80%, 90% accuracy that if you give a patient whose tumor has been removed, that there will be a 90% or 80% chance that they will not have a recurrence if they take the vaccine?
They haven't published the results yet, so I won't be able to tell you.
Are you hopeful?
I'm hopeful.
Optimistic?
I'm optimistic.
How do you feel about the results?
I feel good, but there were some issues with the with using the adjuvants that we were using. So there was, there could be some toxicity because of the adjuvants. So we have to be, we have to go back to the bench and redesign it a little bit.
Scientists, researchers like yourself work in test tubes, they work with lab animals, and eventually, if they're lucky and they're on the right track, they go into human trials, these clinical trials like the one we're talking about. But clinical trials are not fail-safe. People do have terrible side effects and sometimes die because of clinical trials, and in many cases, they're getting the placebo. They're not getting the actual vaccine. That seems to me would be difficult for scientists and doctors to deal with because
yes.
They know some people are not going to be helped by the treatment. They know some people are going to have adverse and sometimes highly detrimental side effects. How do you deal with that? It's not because it's no longer in a test tube. It's in a human being.
How do we deal with that? That's a good question. And really the dealing comes with we are going to learn so much. The patients are consented. Mm-hmm. And they know what they are getting into. So we're very, very careful to consent the patients and educate them enough before they actually go into these clinical trials. And they are trials, They are trials.
Because you're testing dosage.
You're testing dosage. You're testing safety. You're testing all of that. You're not initial clinical trial is never to look at efficacy. If you do get efficacy, that's wonderful. But normally it's just dose escalation. See if how much dose can be given, whether these patients are developing toxicity. Mm-hmm. It's really based on that. And then it goes to phase two clinical trial where you can look at some efficacy.
There's been a lot of discussion in this country about vaccines, not the vaccine that we're talking about this morning, but the smallpox vaccine. People don't want to give it to their kids because they're afraid it will harm their children in some way. You have said, and I'd never seen this in print before, but you have said that the only thing that has really revolutionized our health care over the years, the only thing, is vaccine. Really the only thing?
No,
not laparoscopic surgery, not antibiotics?
No, antibiotics. I totally agree. Antibiotic surgery and vaccines. I think it was taken out of context.
Okay,
I think what I meant was really eradicating a disease. The only thing that has eradicated a disease, I can only remember, it is really the vaccines. Yes, antibiotics, absolutely. They don't eradicate the disease, but they definitely remove your bacteria that you're suffering with and therefore helping your survival from that disease. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, 100%, I believe in that. But that's not prevention. That is cure. That is a symptom that we are trying to curb. It's not preventing that disease. What I meant really was, what can we prevent? I mean, really eradicated something.
Right. Well, the vaccine that you've developed for breast cancer that's being tested, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is also being tested for pancreatic cancers. Is that true?
No? Not yet.
Not yet. When we come back then, we're going to talk about something else that you've discovered, and that is a way to look for a cancer before we know that it's there, which I think is very important. We'll come back and talk to Dr. Pinkham Mukherjee about that and more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Black Hawk Hardware, located in the Park Road Shopping Center, locally owned and mismanaged since 1977. Black Hawk, where hardware, home, and garden meet. Info at blackhawkhardware.com. and Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting Grammy Award-winning legend Natalie Cole with her captivating tribute to Latin music's legendary composers, June 25th at Belk Theater. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. Well, Pope Francis has called for urgent action on climate change, citing concerns for the earth and the poor. So on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, they'll look at the global environmental policy and the role of the Roman Catholic Church in all of that. If you'd like to join our conversation, now would be the time. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back in 90 seconds. Well, 30 seconds, actually.
Morning Edition is awake around the clock to bring you the latest news.
It's 2:10 in the morning, so still 5 hours left.
The hosts are usually here around 3:30.
You have Ophibia at 4,
uh-huh.
And it's about the Boko Haram ISIS news over the weekend.
Crunch time is 4 a.m.
Until 5 when the show starts.
Hit it. Open.
Good morning, I'm David Green. With
Morning Edition. Up all night to bring you all you need to know. Listen every weekday.
Morning Edition from 5 until 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and sitting with me in our Spirit Square studio is Dr. Pinko McGirchy, who is the Erwin Belk Endowed Distinguished Professor of Cancer Research in the Department of Biological Sciences at UNC Charlotte, and the winner of the OMAX Gardner Award, the highest faculty accolade given by the Board of Governors every year, from the 17 campuses of the University of North Carolina system. And we're talking about her work in cancer research, in the development of vaccines, and also in the development of a procedure for early detection of cancer before a patient may even know that they have a cancer. Before we talk about that, though, pancreatic cancer has historically almost always been lethal for whatever the reason. There seemed to be very little hope of the cure. Why has that been a case, and what makes it so difficult to treat, and what are you doing to make it less difficult?
The main problem with pancreatic cancer is diagnosis. It's not diagnosed early enough.
Mm-hmm.
There are no symptoms, no signs for a long time. And by the time there are any symptoms and patients go to the doctor, they already have, you know, the tumor that is untreatable almost. Only about 20% of the patients are actually eligible for surgery. So you can't even surgically remove the cancer once detected. So the only way they are treating it right now, other than the surgery that they do, which is a very difficult surgery, is radiation and chemotherapy, mostly chemotherapy. So it becomes almost an untreatable tumor. It's also in a location that's so difficult to probably reach, and it's in an area where, you know, your blood vessels are very, you know, the important blood vessels are moving through that. So mm-hmm. That's why they are not resectable many times. And so what they are trying to do is make it smaller using chemotherapy, radiation, and then going in for surgery or, you know, things like that. So it's just that it's diagnosed late right now.
You have found a way to help doctors detect these cancers earlier, a way to measure markers, you call them, in the body that indicate a cancer's presence. Will this work for breast cancer? Does it work for pancreatic cancer or both or other cancers as well?
Yes, so what we are trying to do here, again, this is not out in the public yet. Mm-hmm. What we are trying to do, as I said, we've spun off a company because of that. It's the antibody that I generated, and the antibody was generated actually to, you know, conjugate to a drug and put it directly to the tumor. Mm-hmm. However, this antibody was able to pick up, you know, this antigen that was shed in the circulation from these tumor cells. So that's how I spun off the company and I said this could be a biomarker that we look for very early on in the serum of patients. So it's a blood test.
So men know about this because hopefully most men get a PSA test for prostate cancer, which is simply a blood test, and they look for specific prostate-specific antigens,
correct,
in their bloodstream. And if there are too many of them, they look into it because there may be a problem. That's what we're talking about here as well for these other cancers.
Mm-hmm.
Why has it taken so long to develop something like this when we've had the PSA test for a long time?
No, we've had breast cancer tests too. So CA15-3, CA27-29, CA19-9, which is used for pancreatic cancer, PSA. So there have been several of these tests out there in the market. The problem has been that they don't distinguish always between the tumor form of that antigen
mm-hmm.
and the normal or benign form of that antigen. That has been the issue. So many times an inflammation in your organ can also get these antigens out in your bloodstream.
Right.
And then when you detect that, you think, oh my gosh, I have cancer.
And that's the problem with PSA test in many cases.
Yes, yes. So it doesn't distinguish clearly if you really it's just cancer or is it something else. And then you go through the biopsies and all of that.
What are you doing in your research to try to make that different, to make it distinguished clearly that it's a cancer?
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. So this antibody I developed is so precise to the tumor form of this antigen that it doesn't quite recognize the normal form. We're still doing a lot of clinical trials to prove this out in all of the organ system, but we believe that we can really, you know, have a test that could distinguish between just the tumor form or the normal form of that antigen.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes the normal form of that antigen is also shed. So that is where I think our test would be a little bit different from the others.
You are the sole inventor of this antibody test, I'm told, and you spun off this company from UNC Charlotte called Oncotab. How unusual is it for researchers today to start their own company as opposed to giving or working in concert with some big pharma company to help develop and then distribute this discovery? Whatever it may be.
It's becoming more common.
Why? Because Big Pharma doesn't want to get involved?
Yes, Big Pharma doesn't want to get involved until you have shown a lot of proof of that concept. And when to do that, you need a lot of money to prove that out. So many times, researchers are... You know, there was a Wall Street Journal article in 2014 that said that about 818 companies from laboratories have been generated, every year. And it's going up every year. It was 600 in 2011.
Does this fast track it?
It fast tracks it somehow, but there are a lot of issues too with it. It fast tracks it only because once you have a company, you can now get money, which is a different pot of money, and you can really do it as a commercial angle. How do I commercialize this?
But how do you, you're a single person. I mean, how do you, what I'm saying is that you started this company. It's in comparison to Smith, GlaxoSmithKline, whatever the heck they're called, it's tiny. And it's underfunded. Those people are billion dollar industries. If they don't think it's affordable to do this research or to cooperate in doing this research, how can you possibly do the research on your own at the level of money that it would take to do it? How do you do it?
Oh, you don't. You do only part of it, and then you expect that those same pharma are going to get interested now because you've done the phase ones or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the hope. That is the hope. Or to make it, your own lab where the testing will be done. They're called laboratory, tests, which are becoming extremely common in this country and elsewhere.
But underlining again the need for research dollars, because it's not going to come from commercial enterprises.
No, it does saying? Come from angel investors or venture capitalists.
Okay.
The money comes from them and from grants that you get from NIH. So you do get grants also to do this type of work, which is a separate pot from your research money that comes to your academic lab.
Let's talk about you for just a second. I don't want to run out of time before we talk about you and how you got to where you are today. You were born in India. You studied in Bombay, which is now...
Mumbai.
Then at the University of London,
yeah.
You spent about a decade at the Mayo Clinic. spent time later with Johns Hopkins Hospital or University, and have been at UNC Charlotte since 2008. These are impressive credentials. Johns Hopkins, Mayo Clinic. What lured you?
I wasn't in Johns Hopkins.
You weren't?
No.
Well, another piece of information that is wrong.
Yeah, I was at Mayo Clinic.
All right, well, fine. Mayo Clinic is big enough. What lured you to UNC Charlotte?
The true answer is that my husband worked for Bank of America for a long time, and he was transferred here, and it was a family decision for me to look for something over here from Mayo Clinic. So I just didn't move with him. There was a recruiting at that time from Charlotte Research Institute and UNC Charlotte for Irvin Belg Endowed Professor for Cancer Research. And that's how that happened. So I applied to that position and I was recruited.
Has it proven to be a good decision?
I was extremely nervous before because there's no medical school here. That was the most nerve-wracking part for me because there was no clinic and no. So when I came, the most important thing for me was to see what's out there in CHS and how they can support my translational research because all of my research was translational in Mayo Clinic as well. So it was really hard, but I think it turned out to be really good because I've kind of brought three people, senior level people with me to UNC Charlotte, and UNC Charlotte supported me a lot in really making my program successful. And then also the material transfer folks in UNC Charlotte, the getting the patent, getting all of that was really, really helped by them. They're very supportive of their faculty who do such type of things. So I think overall it was good for me to move, but I was very skeptical before.
You are not just a researcher, you are a teacher and you're a mentor of young people. You've been described as inspirational as a teacher, but I've read that you learn a lot from your students. How so?
Yeah, students are wonderful. They actually have questions that you never think sometimes. So they really, read different articles than you normally read. And so sometimes they come up with ideas that you said, wow, this is pretty cool. Let's do it, that kind of stuff. I think I learn a lot about their personalities, about where they are going in life. And my goal is, to be able to educate the next generation of scientists because not many people want to go into science. And
you understand why you love it so much. So do you understand why people don't want to go into it?
Yeah, it's money. There isn't much money in it. It's really that. It's a huge struggle to get into professor level position. You have to constantly publish. You have to constantly get dollars, to do your research. It's not easy. It's extremely difficult to do. And plus, the salaries are not that great. I mean, so I think that. I think that's what it is. Getting money to do your work is
so
dwindling.
It's not how we educate younger people, because it requires rigor to understand science.
Yes,
it's not easy to understand it. You're talking to somebody who got a D in chemistry. For me, it was very challenging. So it's not that. It's not the fact that we're not giving young people a sufficient foundation in math and science so that they can grow from that foundation. It's more of the fact that they look at the salary levels, the potential earnings that they might get as a scientist and say, now I'm going to do something else.
Yeah, I mean, I interact with so many young people and they all want to go into professional lines, not into really innovative science. It's very few students that I see will say, oh, yeah, I want to do a PhD. That's my passion. There are very few who will say that. Everybody wants a professional line so that they are safe.
Why did you do it? I mean, you grew up in India, and I'm sure that I'm sure it's a completely different system over there, but it's generally recognized that the pay scale is much less in India. Why did you want to go into it?
I actually went into it a long time ago. My aunt was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was little, and I actually wanted to be a singer at that time. But, you know, when she got diagnosed with breast cancer, all I saw was my cousins were devastated. I didn't see what was happening to her, but it was just horrible to see my cousins. And so I said, you know, in the back of my head, there was something that, you know, I should do something about this. But it wasn't until I went to England that I really was, you know, driven to do this immune type of work. And then I came to Penn State to do my postdoctoral fellowship, and I just loved doing what I did. And so I think mine was more naivety. I didn't think of money. I didn't think of anything like that. I thought if I do something passionately and I love what I do, money will follow. Mm-hmm. And that's what I tell the students, that just do good science and keep doing good science and money will follow.
But you won this award, the Omax Gardner Award, because they give that award to the faculty member who has done the most for the human race. Does that get you up in the morning? Is that part of what gets you up in the morning and makes you look forward to going into the lab and continuing what you did yesterday and the day before with no promise of success? Mm-hmm. Or is it the promise of success and the fact that you have experienced some success and the impact that success has had on other people that keeps you going?
I think it's a combination of both. It's a combination of both. I mean, I know there may not be success at the end of the road, and I also know that what success I have can become more successful and more meaningful in the future.
Where do you see your work taking not only you, but science in the next 10 years, 15 years?
Not me, but my science. I think I would love to see something where, say, for instance, in breast cancer, mm-hmm. women with dense breast, they really have nothing. I mean, mammograms miss 50% of those tumors. So they really have nothing. I mean, how can I help these women getting a simple blood test and, you know, not having to go through this agony of whether I have a test that would determine whether I may have breast cancer or not?
Well, to do that, we need to get you back to work right now. Pinko Mukherjee from UNC Charlotte, thank you for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer